What were some formative experiences that influenced your career trajectory?
It's really hard to point to one specific thing. I think there is an idea that we can tell the story of our lives like a fiction novel or a movie where certain key aspects became really informed who we ended up being. And I don't think that's really easy to do for, almost 38 years on Earth. But I can tell you a few things that sort of informed where I am now. And, such it is, my career and life, such as it is. So, when I was a kid, I did a lot of not even a lot. I was not athletic, but I did do little kid baseball for 3 summers. I was in a bowling league actually through all of middle school and high school. And then a really formative experience, I think, was in high school when I was in basically every band possible. Like I would skip lunch to I played trombone and I would be in my normal band and then I would skip lunch and be in another band and then I would like skip a class and be in this other band and then I would do marching band and I was like a marching band officer. So I was the president of my high school marching band. I did pit orchestra for the musical, which is we didn't have an orchestra, so it was really pit band, but they used to give like the cello part to the trombone player and stuff like that. So I did a lot of music, and I did the piano on my own time. In terms of like employment experiences, I had some jobs growing up. So my main job as like a kid was to work in my dad's dry cleaner tailor shop, and it's going to sound like I'm from another century, but I guess I sort of kind of am. I made a penny a minute as a kid, and then I got promoted to $1 an hour, and probably just because it rhymed. Doesn't even dollar hour. Yeah, kind of rhymes. And I would do that anytime I needed to save up for something, like saving up for Super Nintendo, which I bought. After working 120 hours, I guess, at the dollar an hour rate. And the work I had there wasn't, too incredibly difficult. It was getting people's clothes off the conveyor belt rack, like the conveyor that has all the hooks on it at the dry cleaner tailor shop. And I also counted change for people, and it allowed my dad to like do the tailor work in the back while I sort of worked in the front of the shop. And it wasn't like, a ton of hours. It was probably like, 3 hours a day, like after school until dad went home. And then I had some other jobs. I had a paper route at one point. I taught piano and trombone lessons to kids in the neighborhood. I never had any more than like 3 students at any one time, but it was, enough for like gas money, I guess, once I was old enough to drive. And I was a lot cheaper to those kids' parents than like a professional teacher. Science jobs. So when I went to college at Boston University, I got like a pretty big, they didn't call it a need-based scholarship because I think they might have thought that that was like insulting or something. So it had some name, but it wasn't the merit-based scholarship that like my roommates had. It was some other thing. So I didn't, I had like, a good dining plan and some spending money that like my parents sent me for like my freshman year. But then I actually got lucky enough to get a paid research position as an undergrad, which was really cool. That was through the Beckman Scholars program, which UCSD has had in the past. I don't think it has it right now, but we definitely have had it before. And yeah, so those are like jobs. Then my research experiences, they sort of started out in elementary school. So I was in this program called REACH, which was sort of like the club for like smart kids where they would go during lunch so that we didn't like get bored in our normal classrooms. And they had a really cool project. So the teacher that ran that program, his name was Mr. Dupre. He died not too long ago, way too young actually. And he was really an innovative educator, especially for like the kind of school district that I grew up in. It was kind of a town in the middle of like a very rural part of Western New York State. And he had like the solar car project that we got to work on, this like waterworks project, which is kind of like an art exhibit, sort of like when you go to like a mall and they have those like ball things where like the ball gets shot up and then it falls down into this like sort of like obstacle course sort of thing. But it was like that, but for like streams of water. It was called Waterworks. That was pretty cool. It was also my first exposure to like computers too. So we would like take them apart and, you know, that was really cool. And until I got to grad school, Reach in elementary school was the most research like thing that I did. So that was like really good preparation for grad school. And let's see. So some other things that I did, and this probably gets to the heart of your question. Sorry, I'm going on quite a long time, but I'm almost done. I did a lot of independent projects as a kid. So like, you know, I wasn't the most social kid in the world, probably, you know, in the 10th percentile of social ability, but I did things like, for several years, I recorded every single Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and Star Trek Voyager before they went from Fox to UPN, and then I couldn't watch it anymore because we didn't have cable, and every Simpsons episode. And I put all of those on VHS tape. I had like 200 videos, and I cataloged them, and I had like an electronic record of them. And I programmed games in QBasic on my parents' 486 computer, which I guess was de facto my 486 computer. I'm no good at programming now, but as a 10-year-old, I was halfway decent. And I'd never completed, yeah, I teach engineering, but I've never completed a programming class as a student. And yeah, those are some experiences that sort of became what I do now, going back pretty far in life. Yeah.
Is it better to seek a range of experiences in research or in a job, or is it better to focus in a single area?
I think having a range of experiences is extraordinarily important. For one, you don't know what you like until you have experience doing it. And number two, these different experiences create these intersectional opportunities in your life where you can do things that other people can't do because you have experiences as like a tailor's assistant and as somebody who, you know, cleaned toilets for a summer after orientation students and their parents, and also a good amount of scientific research, you know, before I had to actually decide what it was I was gonna do. And that has is it, it pays off like in the research lab. If you have a lot of different types of research under your belt, you can combine those, and not necessarily like combining because you want it to be souped up. You want to combine it because you want it to be unique. So you can look for the intersection of like human machine interfaces and organic chemistry, and maybe that leads you to some kind of flexible polymer that can interface with biological systems in a way that somebody that does not have training in organic chemistry can, you know, can do. And it's not a question of differentiating yourself in like a competitive manner, like I want to do this because I want to, you know, beat everyone else at doing it. It's because if you can do it and no one else can do it, it means it's not being done, and it means that there's value to be created at that intersectional area that maybe you can do and other people can't. And how is it related to having jobs like, like custodial work or like cashier type work? Well, there are many opportunities in higher education where you can be in a position to broaden access to other members of the community that you don't interact with on a day-to-day basis. And if you can empathize with different audiences, you can teach people about your results and why they're important in a way that somebody who had a very privileged existence for their entire, career and never really left the ivory tower, maybe joined a research lab when they were in middle school and worked the entire way through and didn't really have these other experiences, I think that they would be missing out, I think, in the way in which that they can broaden access to research, appreciation of science, and STEM education in general.
What are the values that underlie effective leadership in research?
As a particular kind of leader that works in academic research, and this is probably applicable to any sort of industrial R&D position as well, so in or national lab position, research should be fun. That's my value. The reason that I got into research is because science is, and I'm putting basically all of engineering research into the category of science. I don't think that will offend anyone's intuition, but like science is the closest, is the only like legitimate route to magic. And humanity is on the verge of like curing a pandemic that might have lasted a decade through the use of mRNA and adeno vaccines. And it would have been like unthinkable to do this 10 or 20 years ago. The fact that we're having this conversation over the internet, and that our voices are clear, and that our pictures are clear, and that basically the entire knowledge workforce is doing work this way. Most medical visits are done this way. And that is incredible and couldn't have been done. I mean, it could have been done in a very rudimentary way 10 years ago, but like the entire economy is now like, okay, not the entire economy, but the knowledge work portion of the economy is running on these platforms. That's something that would have appeared to be magic. The private private companies are now going into space. We have multiple private companies with ambitions in space exploration, which is incredible. And the only way we're going to get there is with science and research. So the value that I try to instill on the people that work in my lab is that science should be fun. And there are a lot of, excuse my language, shitty advisors out there who want to grind their students to dust and who think that that's an appropriate way to treat other human beings. And of course we want rigor, but there's also a lot of selfishness among some people, hopefully a minority of people that have positions similar to mine, especially at elite institutions where students languish. They lose all of that interest that they had in science. They lose that childlike connection to science and magic and learning that I think most of us start out going into research in the service of, and that's kind of stamped out of these people. Some other values that I think are important as a leader are compassion, showing curiosity, anything that you can do as a leader to engage your thinking prefrontal cortex as opposed to the more primitive sections, parts of your brain. Like you want to be selfless instead of selfish. You want to be calm instead of angry. You want to be equanimous instead of anxious. And that's easier said than done, but it's well worth the effort to try to do these things and to have that as your example.
Do you have a mentor or role model?
Do I have a mentor or role model? Yeah. Or even do I? This is a hard one. There are people who are professional mentors, and you literally like pay them to be your mentor. And a graduate advisor could be a good example, or a postdoc advisor, an undergrad research advisor would be a good example. And these people, you know, you get paid, but really you're paying them through your effort to be your mentor. And certainly, the mentors that I've had. That's George Whitesides at Harvard and Zhenan Bao at Stanford have had a huge influence on me and the way that I think about science and research. George Whitesides is he's a super famous chemist, but he is also known as like he's basically an engineer, you know, now hasn't really done chemistry and quite a long time, although there's sometimes chemistry in service of some of the projects that go on in that group. He has a very particular management style. It doesn't work with everybody. A lot of students in that lab languish. Maybe when I joined the group, there were 20 grad students and 20 postdocs, and maybe half of the grad students either mastered out or left science when they graduated with their PhD. But that's because he had a very very particular way of doing things. He's still alive. He's in his 80s. He's interested in a lot of different areas, but very specific areas within those areas. So, you know, he did like microfluidics, and he's one of the founders of the field of microfluidics. And I had this project idea where it was basically, I had just come in as a new grad student, and I'm like, well, maybe we can do like organic synthesis and make molecules in a microfluidic chip. And he said, I couldn't possibly be less interested in that. So one time he wrote on my a paper outline that I handed in that this is illiterate. And there were just some things that he wrote on these outlines that were indescribably like mean stuff that I would never in a million years say to my own students. But eventually these things became like the third rail in my mind. So when I was writing something or preparing a talk, and I'm like, well, at least it has to pass muster with my grad advisor, because if it doesn't, then I'm never going to graduate. And, you know, I'm going to also languish or leave science or something. And once I got on his wavelength, things happened went very smoothly. It helped that I was with, and also like, I kind of felt like I was selling out my interests a lot sooner than I really wanted to. Like, I was really interested in the chemical origins of life, which was a research project that he had in the group. But it wasn't really, he wasn't returning like outlines. He wasn't returning work in that area. So I joined this other project on unconventional nanofabrication using specifically a microtome, which is like a nanoscale deli slicer that uses a diamond knife to make small cuts in stuff to make like these pizza-like slabs that can have different, you know, properties depending on where the pepperoni slices are located. And that became, you know, I became good at that. I never thought I was going to do it, but I became good at it, and I became very interested in the applications that technique was good for. So I couldn't have predicted that ahead of time. So he's a mentor, and I've definitely like internalized things that he's told me. And I tell my own students some of those same things. I usually try to attribute it. But it was often a fraught relationship, and a mentor isn't, you know, it tells you something about a mentor. Like, they're not somebody who is just going to tell you what you want to hear over and over and over again. And you might even get out of their, like, you know, graduate from or escape their tutelage and decide that you want to do something totally different in some approach of yours. But you wouldn't know that unless you had this mentor. So it can be a complicated relationship. Overall, I would still join the same group. I think that my PhD advisor is one of the most unique individuals that I've ever met. He's probably also the richest, maybe the second richest person I know well, because he had, you know, a lot of success in starting companies out of his lab and stuff. My postdoc mentor, Zhenan Bao, she is a fantastically successful chemical engineering professor at Stanford. I was already kind of like trained up because I had been through the gauntlet of George Whiteside's before arriving in her lab. But she did a lot for me. Number one, she's just like super supportive to essentially everyone who like shows up and works hard. She's probably the ratio of like kind as a person to like successful, like the best ratio in like academic science, like very kind, very successful. And it's just amazing, her like breadth of knowledge and curiosity and support. But she was also capable, is also capable of telling you things that you didn't, you know, you didn't want to hear at the time, but you're very glad that you did hear them. And this goes back to like mentorship. Being a mentor doesn't just mean, you know, being a cheerleader. So one time I gave a talk to the Stanford Global Climate and Energy Project. They had like an annual conference in one of the big lecture halls. And I gave a talk, and she said, "You gave a great talk, but your Q&A session was really weak." And she said, "You had all this energy during your prepared remarks, but when you had to speak off the cuff, you fell short. And you need to find a way to bring that energy into your Q&A session and not be defensive when people ask you challenging questions, and to prepare more for the Q&A and to have a better attitude going into it and to speak louder and with more interest." And that really stuck with me. There's not a single, I haven't had a single talk that I've given since then where I haven't internalized, okay, try to maintain the same energy, even though I'm almost done. We can almost go to the dinner, or I can, you know, go home or go back to my office. And that was super important. Further back in life, Mr. Dupre, Daryl Dupre, who ran the REACH program, definitely like taught me curiosity and to embrace like a sense of curiosity. But I'm also going to say my mom. So my, you know, not everyone's parent is a mentor, and not everyone's parent intends to be a mentor, but by example, my mom is definitely a mentor. So she had, I'll just tell you a few like things about her. She's an artist. She went to college. My dad didn't go to college, but my mom went to college for art at the Rochester Institute of Technology in the 60s. And it was, you know, they had a small, at the time, art program. The rest of it was all engineering. And I think they did that because they needed more like women on campus. At least that's the rumor. And she was kind of like, you know, a young intellectual in the 60s, and she had this this box of books that was in the garage that I found one time, and it had like all this sociobiology stuff in it. Like it had Jane Goodall's book, it had a lot of like literature, it had like 5 Aldous Huxley books. Aldous Huxley is my favorite author. Not a single one of them was Brave New World, so she was interested in like the more like metaphysical side of Aldous Huxley, and I read every single one of those. She had a piano, so she bought a piano when she was, I guess, in her 20s, that she carted around with her to you know, everywhere that she lived. That was the piano I like learned to play on, that I grew up on. She had a tape of the Chopin Polonaise in A Flat, Opus 53, and also the first piano concerto in E minor, which to this day are my favorite pieces of music of any style ever. And it's not just because I have a close relationship with them. I really do think like there are qualities about those works that are like superior to most other music that I listen to, and nothing really affects me in the same way. And I think she was onto something with those being like her favorite pieces as well. She also did all the fix-it work in the house. She was like fearless with you know, power tools. She had a bandsaw that was like for art, but also probably for like home repair stuff. She sold her art on eBay, and I used to help her with that. Like, and I used to get some like percentage of the sales, because I was like the tech savvy like boy. So yeah, I helped her with that. And yeah, and then even things like when I get hurt, like injured, like I have like a running injury or something, and I broke my toe like I did 2 months ago, I think back to the time when it's like in 2004, my dad just had prostate cancer surgery and was incapacitated, and then mom was at the post office and broke her kneecap in 3 pieces on the pavement because she tripped, and drove home on with a broken kneecap. And I'm just like, there was a scene in the movie Troy, which did not age well, but anyway, this movie Troy, where Brendan Gleeson's character, who he played Menelaus, gets hit in the face with Paris's sword, played by Orlando Bloom, and this is like a lucky hit, like Paris is supposed to lose this fight, and Menelaus spits out his teeth and then keeps on fighting. And that's how I picture my mom getting through that that moment. And there have been aspects of like you know, times of injury or defeat when I just picture that when I derive strength from the fact that my mom was able to get through this. And even now, like keeping taking care of my dad, who's who's 90, and she just retired basically in the middle of COVID because she didn't want to go back to work and, you know, expose herself and her family to the coronavirus. But she was like doing that full-time job plus all of these art and literature classes that she was teaching in the library, plus her regular job at the library, plus taking care of dad, which is a full-time thing. And so, yeah, she's a mentor, even if, you know, she's also my mom. Oh yeah. One last thing. She went back to grad school at the age of 68 and not many people are going to do that. So yeah.
What advice would you give to a college undergraduate about to enter the job market, especially during COVID?
Okay, given the COVID pandemic, so I'll give you the general advice, and maybe this is something that, I don't know, advice. I'll say some things and you can take it as advice if you want. And how might that change due to COVID? In general, okay, so the classic commencement speaker thing is to say, follow your passion, right? Everybody's heard that, follow your passion. Lately, there has been a backlash against the P word, where the self-help gurus these days say, passion is bunk. Get really good at something, and then you become passionate about that. And then that becomes your passion. I heard this fantastic interview with Mike Rowe, who is on the Discovery Channel. He's the host of Dirty Jobs. Yeah, and has actually some executive functions on the Discovery Channel too. But he said something great, which was follow your opportunity and take your passion wherever you go. That's very useful. What I would say in general is that passion is getting dumped on a lot, and probably unwarrantedly so. And here's why. There, on the superficial level, you have a passion. Let's say you have a passion for energy, or cancer research, or animal rights, or criminal justice reform, or racial equity and diversity. Good luck making a difference with just that passion, right? Because millions of people are interested in the energy challenge. So what you need to do to like avoid being a drop in the bucket so that your contributions can actually move the needle is to figure out what it is that you can do that other people are maybe not can't do, but are really not that likely to do. And then apply that thing to the big picture passionate project. There are a couple of examples from my own career, and I don't know to what extent I'm moving the needle. Probably not that much yet, but you know, hear me out. So I was interested. I did organic chemistry as a undergrad. I did stretchable electronics as a postdoc. I did nanofabrication as a PhD student. And I'm interested in solar cells. I'm interested in energy. My medium term project is to retrofit my whole house to be solar powered, you know, that kind of level of obsession. I'm a vegetarian in large part because of not just animal rights, but mainly because of environmental impacts. Although animal rights is a nice byproduct. And so what am I going to do with organic chemistry and stretchable electronics and nanofabrication to contribute to the energy challenge? And this wasn't something that I could just like think of, because it required getting this rather deep expertise in these other areas. So let's say that I am I'm like maybe in the, you know, 90th percentile of people in the field of organic chemistry, or let's say of scientists that know something about organic chemistry. I know as much as, like, you know, more than 90% of scientists that know something about organic chemistry. Not like a professional organic chemist, obviously they would know more than I do, but maybe I'm like 1 in 10 of scientists in general. Let's say I'm 1 in 10 of somebody that knows something about mechanics. I don't know a ton about mechanics. I'm not a mechanical engineer. I'm not a physicist. But I know something about the way that materials properties give rise to mechanical properties, even if I don't know like the continuum mechanics part of it as well as an actual mechanician. There's another 1 in 10. Let's say that I know something about how to make small structures and how to fabricate them. So like nanofabrication engineering, maybe that's another 1 in 10. And maybe I'm even a little bit better there. Maybe I'll give myself 1 in 100. So now I have 1 in 10 squared times 1 in 100. So now I have 1 in 10,000. And I am the 1 in 10,000th person that can make an impact using these particular skills, these particular interests. And so what you want to do is find the problem within the big picture thing that you're passionate about, where you can concentrate all of your acuity, your intellectual acuity in that one area. It reminds me of a Star Trek episode where they're trying to blow up this Borg ship. Actually, it's the movie Star Trek First Contact. And Picard says, concentrate all firepower on these coordinates. And so all the ships fire where the Borg cube is the weakest, and it blows up. Now, I'm not just saying I want to make the best solar cell ever. What I'm saying is we can develop polymers for barrier materials for whole transport layers that interact with perovskite or organic semiconductors. We can come up with mechanically resilient adhesives that are conductive for silicon solar modules. We can come up with a better support rack for solar panels on the rooftop or in grid scale that might have a better strength to weight ratio using a composite material than a typical material, and that might reduce the balance of system costs. And if you can tweak any one of those knobs a little bit, you might actually move the needle on the whole exercise, which is solar energy production. So that's an example where you can't really predict what your interests are going to be. You have to follow your opportunities, and then when you have opportunities, you become an expert in those little areas. And after time and experience and talking to people and reading books and watching videos and listening to podcasts, you start to be able to put together a picture of where your stuff can actually make a difference applied to your big passion project, rather than just, I'm going to make a better solar cell. It's not really going to cut it because 5, 10 million people want to make a better solar cell. Did I answer the question? Oh yeah. The second part, how would my advice, So what advice would I give somebody like you who's starting out after spending a lot of time on Zoom taking classes? The good thing is that everyone else that you're competing with is in the same boat. I really hope that students in the Zoom generation, so those that basically those of you who are senior undergrads this year, will junior and senior undergrads this year will take to heart is the fact that you really do have to try to maintain these relationships, even though you're going to be doing them virtually. In some senses, it's easier because you don't have to get out of bed. Like, you do have to get out of bed. You don't have to leave your house. You don't have to, give a sweaty handshake. You don't have to have a very awkward meeting in like a professor or potential mentor's office. You can have a conversation like this. And there's a lot of opportunity. Like, I spoke to people that were my like heroes. Like, I spoke to the economist Tyler Cowen on my podcast, and that was the thrill of a lifetime to chat with him about things. And that never would have happened in the before time. So if you can take advantage of some of these opportunities that lend themselves through the fact that we're at home on the internet, also you could take all of that time that you're not commuting and try to do something else with it, or do coursework better. Like, maybe nudge that GPA up while there's still time. Maybe do another extracurricular, read in some area that interests you. Those are really good ways to spend your time, and can help you like treat COVID not as a drag on your development, but as an opportunity to do some things that you wouldn't have normally.